Kennedy's most significant accomplishment in 3 years was that he packed the Rules Committee in the House. Before, you couldn't get a rule on a bill, you couldn't get it out on the floor. I mean, you didn't even get it to sign the committee, I don't think, until you got a rule first. And if the Senate Rules Committee chairman didn't like it, he just didn't give it a rule. And so the first thing Kennedy did was to get Sam Raven's help, and they packed the committee and changed its makeup and opened, you know, blew the dam wide open and changed the structural makeup.
What kind of people do you plan to bring into state government?
As many good people as possible from wherever I can find them. I think that's, you know, very crucial. We don't owe any political patronage. We've got a freer hand than any gubernatorial or governor-elect will ever have had. And I think we had a chance to put three people on the Consumer Affairs Commission. And that tells you something right there. One of them was a high school teacher and tennis coach from Anderson, South Carolina. He was about 33 years old, named Dwayne Loftus. Another was a black woman named Frances Morris, who's about 54 or 5, has 11 children, was on welfare in Charleston. And the third was Rita McKinney, who's from Greenville and outgoing president of the South Carolina student body. Those were our three appointments to the Consumer Affairs Commission, and all the rest are, you know, the typical savings bank president and, you know, industrialists and et cetera. And so we're going to make a heck of a lot of changes if we get in by the kind of people we bring in, especially the operating people, you know, in agencies. I have to be wheels up at 7:15 tomorrow, which means I got to get up at 6 o'clock. Can we carry on? And you want to come with me?
I wanted to ask you about the black vote in South Carolina. The conventional wisdom, as you heard it, on what must be done, on what you heard about your chances of getting it, on what you did, insofar as black vote was concerned, and what the results were.
Well, I had been told the conventional wisdom that the black vote, you had to buy it, you know, and I was even told by one fella that the price would be $60,000 to $80,000 on election day out on the streets. And I don't think anybody has ever sufficiently written, or I haven't seen it, how the black vote works. It has worked in South Carolina politics. I think that's a shame, because I think it's part of the way things have been for a long time. Well, we just...
What did they tell you about this? Go ahead and elaborate how it does work.
Well, you round up the black leadership across the state, and everybody knows who they are, you know, and you agree to pay them money, theoretically, to get help from... workers on election day to drive voters to the polls who can't get to the polls, to distribute literature, to hand out the ticket, you know, the marked up ballot which tells people how to vote. And you know, the leader that you give the money to takes off, you know, you get $5,000 to one, and he rakes off about $1,000 or $1,500 for himself, and then pays everybody else, and there's a tiered system, and it goes down finally to the guy who's driving a car or watching the polls or getting paid for voting one way or another. Well, first of all, we thought that was wrong, and we're going to do it.
Let me ask you this. You were told this by whom? Not necessarily individual name, but active politician.
A black, for example. A party official, Democratic Party official. Two defeated candidates and a successful candidate for office in 1972. You know,
okay.
It's the great unspoken, unwritten rule. And I was told that we couldn't win because those leaders had already committed to Brian Doan or to Earl Morris, and I couldn't get them. And even if I paid them, I couldn't get them. Well, that's not true. They figured that if I paid them enough, I could get some of it. But we didn't want to do that, and we believed that that old system didn't work anymore anyway. The black electorate is a lot more sophisticated than people give them credit for. In fact, people would walk into the black precincts with an Earl Morris ticket in their hand, marked Earl Morris, and say, "How do I vote for Ravenel?" for the poll watcher. So we relied on television, which blacks watch as well as whites, and our ads were cast to everybody, not just to blacks or just to whites. And it worked. Blacks responded to our campaign the same way whites did.
What facet of the campaign do you think they responded to?
Well, you know, what we want to do is, the major theme of the campaign was that we want to work to try to give everybody a fair chance. And most of the people who don't have a fair chance are poor, and most of the poor are black. So it naturally appealed to them more than it did to the average white, because the average black is a lot poorer in this state. And our estimate is that we got 65 to 70% of the black vote.
This is in the runoff.
In the runoff.
How about the first primary?
30%.
In effect, then you picked up the black vote and went for Morris.
Yes. I think the black vote wanted to vote for us from the beginning, but we were afraid that we couldn't win, and they can't afford to back a loser. And they have a lot at stake.
What did you do between the first and second primary insofar as the black vote was concerned? And in meeting with blacks, talking to them?
Yeah, but no more than we had in the first, before the first primary. But in the second primary, they were listening more. The black leaders were listening. The black people listened all the way along the line. And
you didn't put any money at all into the traditional carpool, this sort of thing?
No. We had the sum total of $2,000 available that day for payment for gasoline, on a voucher basis only. Come in with a gasoline receipt. I mean, we couldn't ask people to carry people to the polls on a volunteer basis and pay the price of gasoline that exists today. So there was $2,000 for the entire state to be paid out on a voucher basis only for gasoline. That was it.
What long-range effect do you think that this is going to have on South Carolina insofar as politicians dealing with, quote, the black vote is concerned?
Well, it's a historic change that's taken place. No longer is the black can the black vote be bought. Never again. And nor can it be influenced by paying money to the leadership. You see, well, our premise was that the basic alienation that exists between leaders and institutions and their constituencies exists in the black community as well. In fact, there was great discord in the black community in South Carolina, with Ida Quincy Newman supporting Brian Doan and Oscar Butler supporting Earl Morris, and they split the rest of the leadership. So there's a great alienation in the land, I think, across the nation. And in South Carolina, between leaders and the people who are supposed to have chosen those leaders. It's a great feeling about leadership and the institutions of authority don't care about me. My opinion doesn't matter. I don't have any influence over them, and I can't make any difference. That same feeling exists in the black community. So the black leadership had less ability to control its people than ever before.
All right, you were talking last night when we broke off about there's almost a story to be written about the campaign itself. What is that story? What made it different?
Well, I think, first of all, the risks that we took
it started late in the first place by not declaring until March 25th when everybody thought we had a good chance at having a June primary. On top of that, I had a residency uncertainty, and we took a big risk there, gambling that we would win it. And the third big risk was a financial risk. I took out a second mortgage on my house and put up the first $30,000 of campaign expenses because I didn't feel it was right to ask other people to take the financial risk of a residency problem. Big enough risk to, you know, to contribute thinking that you could just lose. We took a giant risk, a strategic risk by announcing before the Democratic convention and then gambling that the State Democratic Committee would accept my filing when the rule of thumb that morning was that they would not. And what then would we do if they refused to accept the filing? Would I run as an independent or not? We were prepared to do that if we had to. The risk that we would get a ruling in time to clarify the matter before the election and that we gambled that we would get a primary that was later than June. And we desperately needed that extra time. We gambled that not only would the court ruling be favorable, but the political results would be on balance favorable rather than unfavorable. Everybody said, well, even if you win, you're gonna be branded as a carbon bagger. It'll hurt you politically. In fact, it helped us. People saw us as an underdog being besieged by the establishment. Why aren't they letting this boy run? That's what everybody said.
Was that perception heightened by the fact that Westmoreland being similarly situated, except he had never voted, being in the military?
You mean, what feeling heightened?
Of them picking on you, you know.
I think, yeah, a little bit. They said, well, if he's got the problem, why didn't Westmoreland? A little bit, yeah. We took the risk that, you know, here we were with no political base at all. We took the risk that we could put one together. Coalition of the disenchanted. We had no built-in party, no built-in loyalties around the state on which we could call for help. We had to create out of thin air an organization. The gamble was that could be done. It was. I took a tremendous personal gamble by signing these notes for $175,000 to $200,000, which meant that if I'd lost, I'd be bankrupt, personally broke. Absolutely dead bust broke. And I took that risk. It's a story of risk. And then the risk, all the conventional wisdom is you gotta use billboards. Brian Doran used billboards, Earl Morris used billboards, Ken Holland used billboards. You know, everybody's always used billboards, we used none. Everybody's always used direct mail, we used none. Everybody's put money on the streets to buy the black vote, we used none. And instead we put it all on the television. Worked.
The other thing you did that was different was you brought in an outside campaign consultant.
Yeah. I believe in getting the best there is. I don't care where the hell they come from. And Marvin Chernoff is amongst the best in this nation. And now, see, it's not such an evil thing. John Chenrette has a guy from Ohio running his campaign this year. Everybody said that all these peripheral things made a difference. You haven't voted in New York, you got a residency problem, you got an outside campaign manager, you don't have any of the political establishment for you, you don't have the black vote for you, you know. All of those peripheral things didn't matter. They think that those theses left out the fact that assume that the people of South Carolina are kind of stupid and are in, and the primary vote is locked up, controlled. Now, people are a lot smarter than anybody gives them credit for it. We simply presented a campaign which addressed the issues that we knew the people were worried about because we polled them to find out. and gave our answers to those problems and made sense, we believe, and the people read it and saw it and understood that it made sense and voted that way. All these things didn't matter to them.
Why did you take your position on capital punishment, which was not, the poll showed, was an unpopular position?
Why was it unpopular?
The poll showed your position was basically an unpopular position.
Yeah, but not by a dramatic amount. I remember it was 56% against capital punishment. I mean, for capital punishment, 44% opposed. So it wasn't in the white communities, there was a large dissatisfaction with my stand. Not large, some dissatisfaction with my stand. But in the black community, it won a great deal of support. Now, I did it because that's the way I feel, not to get any votes. I think on balance it hurt me. But not so much. People would much rather know where you stand, even if they disagree with you, than to have you wishy-washy on a thing. I mean, Morris and Dorn said, well, we believe in limited application of capital punishment in some cases, but not. I mean, that, what kind of, you're either for it or against it. And I think that approach was key to the treatment we got from the press. With virtually no exception, well, only one exception. The press was treated absolutely straightforwardly, honestly. We answered every single question put to us, and we didn't give them a mealy-mouthed answer. And we got fair treatment from them.
But exception to the Ziegler thing?
Yeah. I learned something from that. You know, that was damaging.
What did you learn? What was the lesson?
Well, the first lesson was all this stuff about getting somebody else. What somebody else does is almost totally irrelevant. It's what you do that matters. And so my trying to talk him in or suggested that he drop out and support me was, you know, fraught with great risk and small return. And the second thing I learned is that when asked a question that I don't want to answer, I'm going to say I'm not going to answer that. Instead of getting cute and sophisticated about giving an answer, which is a true answer, but leaves a wrong impression. And that's what I did on that, because I gave Nick Ziegler my confidence that I wouldn't tell anybody about our conversation. So when I was asked point blank, you know, if you had a conversation with Nick Ziegler, I felt a higher obligation to maintain that confidence I'd given him in my word than I did to answer the spirit of the question. Instead, I answered it. I gave a technically correct answer, but it was a misleading one in terms of the spirit of the question. And I perfectly understood it. Well, you got to go back. I saw Nick Ziegler on Friday in Florence. I was in Florence on Saturday, but did not see him. And I saw Nick Ziegler on Sunday night in Pullman. So I was asked, have you recently talked to Nick Ziegler about dropping out and supporting you? And I said the following. The last time I saw Nick Ziegler was in... No, I said... I gave him the following answer. The last time I was in Florence was Saturday at a cancer tennis clinic. And I did not even see Nick Ziegler. And then on the last time I saw Nick Ziegler was Sunday night, he and I didn't discuss it. Both those statements were true. But I left out the fact that I saw him on Friday. I knew what the hell he was getting at, and he knew, and he trusted me to answer him fully and directly, and I didn't do it. But my fear was that if I'd said, you know, I don't want to comment on that, then they'd immediately know that I'd done it. And I would have violated the spirit of the agreement with Nick Ziegler.
What do you think your victory is going to have on the type of candidate who runs in South Carolina in the future?
On the what kind of candidate?
The type.
I think it's going to change dramatically.
the type of candidate, because they're going to be a lot more young people, fresh people, who will run. And who'll be undeterred by the fact they've had no political experience. And I think, secondly, some of the old pros who used to run with impunity are going to change the way they do business, because they'll never know when there's a Punk Ravenel or somebody like that breathing over their shoulders, and they better be more responsive.
Do you think this is going to make a substantive difference in the state legislature in the next 2 to 4 years?
Yes. I think it will make an important difference. Different kinds of people who heretofore would never run will run, I hope.
How do you assess your role? What sort of role do you plan to play insofar as the Democratic Party is concerned?
That's a tough question. The governor is, you know, the leader of the party, titularly and in practical terms.
It's a great challenge to try to bring some coherence to a party in an era when people don't have the same party loyalties that they used to have. And people vote independent, they vote the man. And that makes parties a sort of an anachronism. However, I believe that even though it's an anachronism, I guess you could say about it what Winston Churchill said about democracy. You know, it's the two-party system is the worst possible system. It's the worst system. It's a terrible thing. It's the worst possible system except for all the rest. And so I believe in a two-party system, and therefore I think my role will be to open up the Democratic Party and invite in all these fresh people who are thinking about running, encourage them to run within the framework of the two-party system and to come into the Democratic Party. That would be my principal goal and objective.
All right, let's assume you win in November. You asked, I think you commented, made some comment about whether or not you may run against Strom Thurmond.
Well, you know, I really, in 1978, I don't know what I'm going to do. In 1978, I don't know whether Strom Thurmond is going to run for re-election. I don't know if he's going to be there. I don't know. I may be fed up with the political process. I may have made taken so many unpopular stands that I think are right that I couldn't possibly win. I mean, I think it's ridiculous to speculate about what you're going to do 4 years from now. But I wouldn't rule out the possibilities that I would run in 78 against him if he's the Republican nominee. I would try. It's possible. I would try to do that, but I am in no way have that as a target right now any more than I had as a target to run for governor. Obviously, if I had it as a target to run for governor, I would have got my ass down here sooner, so I wouldn't have had a residency problem. So I don't think you can plan more than 6 months ahead in politics. So. If I do a good job, if I'm still interested in the political process, if I think I can win, if I think the people of South Carolina would vote for me, then I may do it.
What do you think would have to happen for the Democrats to carry South Carolina in a presidential election next time?
What would have to happen to make that happen?
Yeah.
A real good Democratic candidate.
Such as?
Well, who knows? Dale Bumpers. I don't know, some fresh new rising star. I don't see anybody. I don't see that person being Ted Kennedy, certainly. I don't see it being Hubert Humphrey. I don't see it being Scoop Jackson. I don't see it being, Mike Mansfield, too old. I don't see any rising stars on the national Democratic scene. Lloyd Benson? Yeah. Maybe. Walter Mondale, I don't know. Haven't met him.
You see anyone like Terry Sanford being any realistic possibility?
I think Terry Sanford is a terrific guy, but I think his day has passed.
Yeah.
But you never know, you know, you just never can tell.
Thank you a lot, my friend.
You don't count. The name of Ravenel from Charleston more or less suggests a great aristocratic background. So where do you fit in with the Charleston Ravenels?
Well, I share their name. There are Ravenels with financial means in Charleston, and there are Ravenels without it. And we are one of the Ravenels. My family is one of the Ravenels without it. You know, it was lost back in the Civil War. Excuse me. I'm proud of the name, and I'm proud of the name that it is, you know, that it is a clearly identifiable as a South Carolina name. And an extra sense of responsibility to live up to what South Carolina and Ravenels throughout history have meant to each other, and would really like to play a part in a role in giving substance to that connection.
I've read your father's a sheet metal worker. Is that?
My father is not now a sheet metal worker. He was a sheet metal worker for 17 years when he started in the Depression and times were tough. He became a leading man and had people working for him, and later became an industrial relations specialist, which it means that he was because he had been a working man, worked between management and labor, helping to mediate disputes. But all in my growing up period, he was a sheet metal worker. But then when I was about, 16, 17 or 18, or somewhere around in there, he became an industrial relations specialist.
That's what he does now?
No, he's retired now.
Who did he work for at that time, the industrial relations specialist?
He worked for the same people. He worked for the Navy Yard. He was a civil servant and worked for the the civil service in the Navy Yard. In Charleston.
Let me ask you a philosophical question. We talked about this a little bit last night, but what do you think your election means insofar as Southern politics is concerned?
Well, I think my election is just another example of a change in the political patterns that have existed in the South since the Civil War. And before, there were a small group of very powerful people who controlled the state by controlling their successors. And my election and the election of other people like Jimmy Carter and some others in Georgia, Dale Bumpers, Reuben Askew, and Lawton Childs, has broken that system of self-fulfilling destinies whereby people choose their own successes and therefore maintain control.
What does it mean insofar as the politics of George Wallace?
Well, I think the thing that George Wallace and I have in common in terms of strategy is that we both have said the institutions and the individuals in authority have forgotten about the little man. They've forgotten about you and me. And let's not let them get away with it. Let's change it. He said that. I said that. It has worked enormously for him. It has worked enormously for me because it is the way people feel. And it is right that the institutions and leadership has tended to forget about the people who put them there. So it's appropriate and proper, I think, to change that. And thank God for the ballot box, which makes it possible to bring about those changes. that's what George Wallace was all about. You know, he represented the articulation of the feeling of alienation that most people had between themselves and the institutions and individuals in authority. And I feel that was the single most important feature of my campaign.
Where do you see yourself that is different from Wallace?
Well, Wallace's, my perception of Wallace's stand on civil rights is that he is relatively conservative, even now, in spite of the fact that he's changed somewhat from the old days when he stood in the door of the school. And I think I tend to be more moderate on civil rights than he. He tends to be more conservative and less flexible than I, if I understand properly his philosophy. I think that's the major difference. Also, I think, you know, I've been a businessman. I've never been in politics, and my expertise is trying to protect taxpayers' dollars by better and more efficient management and administration and the technical capability to run an administration. I don't know if he has that.
How many paid people working in your state?
33 were working there on election day.
How many were black?
Oh, I counted up once, I think about 8. You know, Herb Cunningham, is that right?
That's about right.
Well, Francis Morris, Hilda Jefferson, Harold Hill in Charleston,
so.
Jim Self and Atlee Prince, Clement. Forgotten, but he, Joe Strickland,
yeah,
7. Who else? Let's see. We had
Bob Hartley
was 8. About 8 out of the 33.
We
had a hard time getting them because they didn't want to back. You know. They were afraid of backing a loser. And then, Jim Blake. So, that's 9. Anyway, 8 or 9 or 10.
Your statement about state government should reflect the population in terms of the 30% and 30%.
Right.
If elected, do you plan to apply that to the governor's office?
Yeah, I'd like to move in that direction. Yes, I do.
Or do you think the governor's office should set an example?
Sure. I think it must. And I intend to see that it does. And see, we can afford to do that. I mean, that's the really important thing about this, if I win. If we win, I don't owe any people anything except the people. There are people who helped me, but everybody helped me out of voluntarism. There were no huge political favors that I owe anybody. No big honcho supported me whose wishes that I have to respect. And I'll be the freest, least encumbered gubernatorial office holder, perhaps in South Carolina's history. And that's really important. Got to get the hogwash out of education. When they asked him what that meant, he was reluctant to say, apparently, but then said, the hogwash. My children come home with all this art and drama and painting and stuff. Got to get rid of all that. Get back to reading, writing, and arithmetic.
But you do plan to make a major
exclusive.
And you plan to make a major effort on arts, and that would include what, adding art teachers in the schools?
No.
This sort
of thing? It would include support of the arts and the people throughout the state who are trying to bring the arts to the educational process. And, I don't know whether you can, if you just can't bring art teachers, I'm going to be interested.
Okay.
You can't just simply afford to start putting art teachers in every school, et cetera, but you can sure start the process of doing things like. Yes. Supporting the museum effort to bring in the Metropolitan to the state of South Carolina, etc.
surprise you've had out of this race from the whole standpoint of entering politics and from the political experience as a candidate?
Biggest surprise? The tremendous amount of emotional pressure that you have to go through. The distance between feeling in 1 hour that there's no way I can lose to going in the next hour to feeling there ain't no way I can win. And the absolute tremendous pressure that puts on you. When so many people work so hard all over the place, and the pressure not to betray that or make a foolish mistake that blows the whole thing. Just the whole emotional risk of losing, being able to take it.
Any regrets?
What?
Any regrets?
None. Oh yeah, I've done some things wrong I wish I'd never done, like I said last night. But.
End interview with Pug Ravenel. No more transcription. This tape.